Pushkin. Armed with only what she calls poor kid work ethic, Brandi Carlile spent the early part of her life fighting her parents' politics, the church, and fighting to be heard while singing over belligerent drunks in crowded bars.
I haven't heard my mother's voice in a while. All her words are always falling out my mouth.
Brandi's voice demands attention. As you might recall hearing in our episode with Jack White and Brennan Benson, her 2019 Grammy performance of her song, The Joke, blew even her most critical of peers away. But long before that, she was already making a name for herself on stages across the Pacific Northwest, where she was raised and now lives with her twin bandmates she simply calls The Twins. And since then, she's released 6 albums, formed The High Women with Maren Morris and Amanda Shires, and has just generally captured the attention of the music world. In her chat with Rick, she recounts her tumultuous past and talks about how she's learned to pick her battles over her long career. And then there's the night she witnessed a miracle at Joni Mitchell's house. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Brandi Carlile from Shangri-La.
I remember the first time I saw you. And I don't remember how it worked out that you were on the show that I saw you at, but I saw you at a place called the Wilshire Ebel Theater.
Yeah.
And you were opening for James Taylor, and I was there to see James Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know you. And I don't even think I stayed to watch James Taylor after I saw you. I was so blown away. And I remember you got a standing ovation as an unknown opening act.
Yeah.
I remember. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was really a ridiculous performance.
And the people that had come to see it, like from Columbia Records and stuff, they told me the next day, they said, God, you know, there was no way backstage at that show, but on the stage. And there was no intermission between me and James. And James came out to play his first song, and the whole theater saw you walk backstage during Fire and Rain. And they were like, Rick Rubin's going back there. We got to sign this girl. He sees something, and when he sees something, it's real. And, you know.
It was real.
I really don't think you understand how much of an impact you made in that sense, you know.
Wow. Well, happy to be of service. Had no idea, but happy to be of service. It's
Thank
great.
You, sir. But you actually saw me way earlier than that.
No.
Yeah. Do you want to know?
Yeah, please.
So I'm writing a book, and I'm not sure why I'm doing it, but there's a whole lot about you in there.
Wow.
Because I got asked to open for a guy called Johnny Lang in Seattle, and a guy called Brendan Mendoza was in the audience.
Yeah.
And I was only maybe 19. I'm 39 now, so it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Brendan Mendoza says, I work for a guy called Rick Rubin.
Yeah, he was a young A&R guy who worked at American Recordings.
Yeah. And he flew me to L.A. to play for you at Swing House.
And I have no recollection of that.
Well, I did, because it was a make or break moment in my life that was, of course, and this is an interesting thing I've learned since I gained this notoriety for being an artist, how a public person can have such an impact on another person's life without even really knowing, you know? And it's just this one of the inconsequential things. But to me, it was an enormous deal, because I was being flown there to play for you, and I had got really sick, like laryngitis. And I have this terrible paradoxical allergy to cough medicine that I didn't know about. And I took cough medicine, and I started having a neurological reaction to it. I had involuntary muscle spasms in my face and hands. And I'm sitting there trying to play my showcase for you, and I can't remember the words, and my fingers won't press down on the strings to play the chords. And I had muscle twitches in my jaw, and I just felt like my life was ending. And you interrupted my showcase, and you said, is there something about you today that's making you not be yourself? And I said, yeah, I'm really sick, and I think I'm having an allergic reaction to this cough medication. And you said, well, why don't you go home and get better, and then come back and do this again?
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, right. Yeah, fucking right. I know I'm never going to get a chance to come back here and play for you again. And I went home.
I have no recollection. It's unbelievable. It's a great story.
I went home thinking I'd blown it, and you brought me back 2 weeks later. And I was better, and I was really ready, and I played for you at Swing House. And it's like, I remember what I was wearing. I remember everything. And the very first song I played for you was a song called Shadow on the Wall. And I had showcased for just about every record label, and everyone passed.
Yeah.
And some people didn't even wait till I was finished singing a song before they'd leave the room. And I finished that song, and you put your hand up, and you were sitting just like that. And you said, that's a really amazing song. Will you play it again? And I knew right then that I was going to make it. I knew it. I was like, he wants me to play it again.
Unbelievable.
And I played it again, and it ended, and you said, why don't you just play it one more time?
Really?
Yeah, I played
amazing.
It again. And I played it again. And I played you two more songs, and you had me play those songs again. And by the time it had ended, I'd played three songs 7 or 8 times. And we had a conversation. You told me you'd just seen Damien Rice.
Yeah.
And Johnny Cash was still alive.
Yes.
And you said that you thought we would know each other and work together down the road.
Amazing.
And word spread about that. And, you know, it was looking like I was going to sign to American for a long time. But
I remember that. And yeah. I remember what happened. I remember I was moving from one label to another.
You were in total chaos at the moment.
Yeah. I was moving from one label to another. And I remember that at the new label, whereas my new distributor was going to be Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And I said, this is the first act that we're going to do. And I remember the Warner Brothers people didn't get it and didn't like it.
Yeah.
And I remember, I couldn't believe it. It's like, she's incredible. She's incredible.
No one got it. You were the first one, Rick, to ever get it. You were the first one to ever say, play that again. And so I'll never forget it. And, you know, that James Taylor show that you were at, it made me look so cool. Everybody talked about it for a year after
that. Are you sure that the James Taylor was after the Swing House?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember the Swing House, but I definitely remember the James Taylor because I just couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Well, your life was much different than my life was at the time, wasn't it? You know?
No, I trust you 100%. Yeah. I'm not questioning what you're saying. I'm just telling you, I don't remember it.
Yeah, I bet. You were so beloved and just popular and such an inspiration to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And you brought me back. You gave me a second chance. And at the James Taylor show, also Columbia Records was there. And that's when I got my deal with Columbia Records and made my first album.
Amazing. Yeah. And then I remember when I was at Columbia for a little while, we worked together on...
Give Up the Ghost.
Whatever album you were working on at the time. And I remember it was fun.
It was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
That's still my favorite album, actually.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I love it. It was a big emotional... hard time for me in my life. I don't like who I was really at that time, but I like the album.
Yeah, I just remember the power in the vocals was off the chart, like stunning.
Yeah, because you had me singing into a SM7, right? Is that what they're called? Microphone?
I don't remember.
Yeah, and every other microphone I'd ever sang into, I would distort. So the engineer or the producer would ask me to sing differently.
Yeah.
I ended up doing a little mic control.
Yeah.
And it messed with my performance emotionally. So I never sounded on an album like I did live until that album.
Because we used the same mic you would use live because you sounded good live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were
it seems like it would be obvious, no?
It seems like it would be obvious, but apparently it's only obvious to you.
So since then, how many albums have you made?
7.
7 as an artist.
Yes.
And the last one mm-hmm. was maybe your most well-received of the batch, which is unusual mm-hmm. in today's world because mm-hmm. normally first couple of albums tend to do really good and then people fade away mm-hmm. and you've only kind of continued to build over the seven albums.
Yeah. Yeah, because of that. But some of it has to do with just sort of like a cultural undertone, like where we are in the world right now and the perspective that the album was written from. I think it gave people comfort in a way that it resonated sort of beyond, I think, me as an artist and more into the sort of cultural zeitgeist of like.
I wonder if that's true. I think you're selling yourself short.
Do you think?
Yes.
I don't know. I think it belongs to the moment, but maybe.
Well, maybe it yes, it belongs to the moment. Okay. And yes, the moment plays a role. Mm. But the reason people like it is because you're great. And that's the real reason.
Thank you.
And if
I will receive that.
And if you weren't great and it was right in the moment, it wouldn't matter at all and nobody would notice. It's because it's great. So
thank you.
Tell me about your situation growing up.
Well,
Seattle,
just outside of Seattle. I started out living in the airport town outside of Seattle, SeaTac, Burien area. We moved out to a single wide trailer in the middle of the country when I started fifth grade. And up until that point, we were only allowed to listen to like classic country and Western music. It's what my mother sang and her father and big country music family.
Where were they from?
Oklahoma.
And then they end up in Seattle?
Well, they went up north. So Oklahoma, both sides of the family were actually from Oklahoma. And some of them just migrated around, you know, the country. My great-grandparents lived in an RV. They just toured around following bluegrass festivals, the really small ones, you know.
So it was always a musical family.
Yeah. Yeah, a musical family without us really even knowing we were a musical family. We thought all families were musical families.
So everybody played?
Everybody played something or supported it in some way. And then my mother's side of the family went from there to up north between Fargo and Minneapolis, a place called Waubin, northern Minnesota. They started the whole it's not southern, it's western thing about country music and moved west. And so country music was our family's thing. And I got out to the country for the first time and started to feel weird and gay. And I picked up a fifth grade book report on a kid called Ryan White, who died of AIDS in 1991. He was a hemophiliac. And when he was diagnosed with HIV, the church tried to politicize him and get him to speak out against gay men and imply that it was a disease that was created by gay men. And in the book, he was befriended by a guy called Elton John. And I saw this book report as a departure from my family in a weird way. Their politics, something was starting to become clear about my sexuality because I was 11. And this guy Elton John seemed really special to me. So I went to the King County Library and I checked out two CDs, Tumbleweed Connection, and the one here and there that had Skyline Pigeon on it because he sang it at this kid's funeral. And I loved that boy and wrote this big book report on him. And I checked out a biography by Philip Norman, and I got into David Bowie via Elton John and also Queen. I became fascinated with Freddie Mercury, George Michael, U2, and the Beatles, all in this on this biography that I had read. And I started dressing different, talking different, arguing politics with my dad, and started liking a different kind of music and started standing out and becoming an artist. And it was hard. It was hard on my parents spiritually, politically. It was hard because we were poor and I was already weird enough at school. But that's when I started to take a turn away from just playing the spoons and singing at family jams to really wanting to be an artist.
And then when did you start singing? What was your first professional experience singing?
We had these auditions at this place called the Northwest Grand Ole Opry, where my mom's dad was the kind of patriarch, family, yodeling, very glamorous, amazing man. He died really young of Lou Gehrig's disease, actually. He was only 50. And with the money he left, which was not much. It was just enough for my mom to buy a little PA system. And she decided to start doing music for real because he was gone and she wanted to do something to heal herself. And she started doing auditions. And she took me with her to an audition at a place called the Northwest Grand Ole Opry. And I got to audition too. And we both made it. And the first song I sang was Tennessee Flat Top Box by Johnny Cash. Second one was San Antonio Stroll by Tanny Tucker. And I started singing on Friday and Saturday nights, rehearsals on Wednesdays.
How old were you at this time?
Eight.
Eight.
I did that till I was like 13 or 14.
Wow.
Also sang in bars and contests and anywhere I could sing. And I sang full time.
Yeah.
And when I was 14, I started singing background vocals for an Elvis impersonator. Learned how to play guitar around 15 or 16 and writing songs and started my own bands. And by the time I was 20, I came to LA and played for you.
Amazing. Amazing. You were ready.
Well, I don't think I was ready, actually, but I was one of the steps for sure.
Well, the fact that you did all of the fact that you'd played in front of audiences for so long mm-hmm. is something so few new musicians have.
Yes.
You know, it's very few and far between that you see people who've done years of playing in front of people before we get to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an experience that comes, there's a level of expertise from that experience that you can't create any other way by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't get years of practice without years.
No, and the main thing you can't get is you can't get over your television understanding that just because you're performing, an audience should listen to you. That's the worst part. That's the most soul-destroying thing for a new artist that doesn't have busking or bar experience, is that they don't understand that you actually have to earn the other person's attention. And it can be really hard work. And sometimes they can be assholes, and sometimes they can be drunk, or they can be walking past you to work. And you have to figure out what it is that's going to make them stop. Put down the beer for even 20 seconds, or stop where they're going and take out a buck and throw it in your guitar case. Like, to any kid, anybody that's just starting out music, I so strongly recommend busking. If you can't get a gig in a bar, busk. Try to figure out what it is that you do with your voice or with your words or your body that makes someone stop.
I would say that it goes for everything even beyond music. It's like the idea that we're just naturally going to be accepted
yeah.
as great
mm-hmm.
doesn't really happen. It's like
no.
you need to go out and prove it.
Yeah, that's real life.
Yeah. So what were some of the methods you would use to get people to stop and pay attention?
I figured out early on that for me, it was volume and dynamics. Sometimes if I couldn't get a bar to quiet down, I would stop playing my guitar and start screaming. Or I would mute my guitar and start whispering.
Yeah.
Just depended on how they were reacting, you know? And I would just try and give them what I thought they needed. And it came with trying to learn to be a musical empath, reading a room, trying to give the people what they want. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I've started to understand that it's not a glitzy or a silly thing to be an entertainer. You know, there's artistry in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just more of a performance. It's a different kind of art, but it's all art. It's all making something beautiful and sharing it with people.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with Rick and Brandi Carlile after the break. We're back with Rick and Brandi Carlile. Here's Brandi singing a song from her latest album, By the Way, I Forgive You.
This song's called The Mother. It's about my daughter, Evangeline, and it's about my path into motherhood and how twisted and rocky and bumpy it was, and how even long after she was here, I wasn't sure I made the right decision.
Wow.
And it's hard for people to admit that they feel that way. But I wanted to write a song about it because once I did admit it, it's like it opened me up to falling in love with her in my own time. And it's a complicated thing.
Mm-hmm.
Gay domesticity is a complicated and sort of new thing, and there's not a lot of pioneering books about it. So I wrote this song.
Welcome to the end of being alone inside your mind.
You're tethered to another, and you worried all the time. You always knew the melody, but you never heard it rhyme. She's fair and she is quiet, Lord. She doesn't look like me. She made me love the morning. She's a holiday at sea. The New York streets are as busy as they always used to be. But I am the mother of Evangeline. The first things that she took from me were selfishness and sleep. She broke a thousand heirlooms I was never meant to keep. She filled my life with color, canceled plans and trashed my car. But none of that was ever who we are. Outside of my windows are the mountains and the snow. I hold you while you're sleeping, and I wish that I could go. All my rowdy friends are out accomplishing their dreams. I am the mother of Evangeline. And they still got their morning paper and their coffee and their time. And they still enjoy their skeptics and the wine. Oh, but all the wonders I have seen, I will see a second time. From inside of the ages, through your eyes. And you are not some accident where no one thought it through. The world that stood against us made us mean to fight for you. And when we chose your name, we knew that you'd fight the power too. Nothing short of magical and beautiful to me. I'll never hit the big time without you. So they can keep their treasure and their ties to the machine. 'Cause I am the mother of Evangeline. They can keep their treasure and their ties to the machine.
About your songwriting process. Is there any, would you say it follows any typical methods or different every time?
It's really changed as I've gotten older. I write a lot less songs now. Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes I will write like one every 2 years.
Really?
And it feels like it's going away, but it never does. And if I always just trust that it won't go away, then it comes back.
Do you think it's because you're on the road so much?
No. I think it's because I've transformed as an artist to be something other than a songwriter, than just a songwriter. It's kind of like an element of who I think I am now, but I'm just as happy to sing songs that the twins have written, particularly because we live together. You know, we all live together now on the same property, and we're married to each other's siblings, and we have babies that all go to school and meet up every morning at the same bus stop. And so much has changed in the last 20 years. Wow. But when they write a song and they bring it through to me, and it's about our friend taking his own life, or it's about, you know, one of our dads in rehab, I know what it's about. And it could have been written by me. And so I still get choked up, and I get a lump in my throat when I'm singing, and it feels like it came from my soul because we're waking up and looking out the same windows every day. So I don't need to be writing a song really to feel moved by interpreting one.
Yes.
But when I do, I'm much, much more spiritually open about having it influenced than I was when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And it always comes from a more honest place, which is interesting because I think because I never had any commercial success per se,
mm-hmm.
I'm not chasing it.
Yes. Which is super healthy. Thank God. Thank you. It really worked out, because had something really exploded early on, mm-hmm. and then there was always this sort of trying to get back to that place, it would have undermined the whole thing.
Yeah, you're right. I really feel like that, and I've observed that now, and I don't want it. I've never wanted it. It's not really what I'm not cut out for that, you know?
And you've had a great life doing what you do on your own terms.
Yeah.
You sing the songs you want to sing. You sing them the way you want to sing
exactly.
them.
Exactly. And I live with my brothers, and I've got my wife, and I've got my babies, and I've got all the things I want. You know, I've got a four-wheeler and a fishing boat, and I'm fine.
I can remember, I won't say the name of the artist, but a very well-known pop star who's a big fan of yours. I don't know if you know who she, I don't know if you know her, but she told me she was so blown away by you, and she made music that was very manufactured pop. And it was like, I was surprised that she liked you because the music she made was so different. And she said, well, if I could do what I want, I would do what Brandy does, but I can't. I'm in this machine and I have to sing this garbage. And literally it was like,
wow,
that's what I want to do. She's doing it. I don't get to do that. I just get to make these pop records.
Yeah. There's a time I felt that way about her, whoever she is.
Yeah.
You know, if I could do what I want, I would be famous.
Yeah.
And I would be, rich, and I wouldn't be so tired, and I wouldn't be taking steroids, and I wouldn't be living in this van. You know, but now I'm just so glad that never happened to me. And it's no insult, because I love a rock star like anybody else loves a rock star. God, I mean, I think fame's a beautiful thing. It's just not my thing.
It's also the path that suits us often finds us. You know, we may be looking for something else.
You're so right.
We find the path we belong on, and and it feels good. Like, you know, like to some degree, it's like we're characters in this movie, and we have ideas of what we want the next scene to be, but we don't get to control that.
And do you think sometimes when we think we're manifesting it, that maybe we're just innately knowing it's ahead of us?
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be.
I don't know, actually.
It could be. It could be one way. And whether it's us manifesting it, or whether it's a premonition of what's to come, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, either way, it's cool to have that feeling of like, oh, I feel like this is going to happen. And then it happens. It makes the experience of living more fun. Like you get to feel like, wow, I'm really in this. I'm in this life.
Yeah. And I'm open to it.
Yeah.
To the twists and turns, you know.
It's hard sometimes when the thing that comes up is something that is really painful.
That's the first thing I thought when I said that too, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard when the thing that comes up is really painful to know, wow, like watching it in the movie and wow, our hero just got into trouble in that scene. I wonder how he's going to get out of this. Do you know what I mean? Like to be able to remove ourselves from the emotion in it and be trusting that the universe is on our side.
Yeah. I mean, the big thing for me is I just made the decision in my very, like right around the time I turned 30, in my early 30s, to stop being in fights, you know? Not to stop standing up for myself.
Yeah.
But to stop being in fights is actually much more proactive. I don't want to say aggressive, because it's not aggressive, but it's much stronger to stop being in fights.
What were some of the things that you might have fought over in the past?
Oh, God, you name it, man. I've been fighting since I was a little kid, just fighting in the schoolyard, fighting people, fighting in relationships, fighting God, fighting the church, fighting over politics, fighting over music, fighting producers. You know, every record I made ended in me falling out with the producer. All, every time.
And what do you think what do you think was underneath it?
Poor kid work ethic. A damage and chaos, and also passion, you know, and like also a little bit of it is being gay and kind of growing up in the church and like having to fight for your actual eternity, you know, and just the dignity of showing up every day and being who you are when no one wants you to, And you take that into places that are inappropriate. But it was appropriate in those scenarios, mm-hmm. you know? And it just took Falling in Love and Saturn Return to kind of make me rise above myself a little bit and see it.
Beautiful. So tell me, how was the last album that you made different than the ones that came before it?
I mean, I was different. We made this album with Dave Cobb and Shooter Jennings. And Shooter Jennings is like a spirit animal person that is like in my life to just remind me not to judge people, remind me not to be uptight. And Dave Cobb was a person that scared me. And I felt like his talent was intimidating and his audacity was intimidating and his guileless authority was intimidating. And I had only made two self-produced records. And I wasn't really planning on going into the studio with a influential producer. And I was trying to put together an album for War Child to benefit refugee kids mostly from Syria and camps in Iraq and Jordan. And I called, I got Dolly Parton to do my song, The Story.
Incredible.
It was so cool, man. But she wanted us to record a track, and I had no idea really what to do. And I had to kind of admit my limitations, and I thought about Dave Cobb because I was getting ready to drive through Nashville, and I just knew that he had a handle on it. And so I called him up, and I was like, do you have time to do this? And he's like, no, I have absolutely zero time, but I will do this in the middle of the night for you because my wife is a refugee. And so we pulled our bus into RCA Studios in the middle of the night, and he played Wichita Lineman in the Ghetto, and then we recorded The Story for Dolly Parton. I left there totally mind blown, thinking I never wanted to work with Dave Cobb, but that I was really impressed.
Yes.
And Shooter and I were going to work together, and we got to talking about it, and he said, I think you should give Dave a second thought. He's my brother, and he loves you, and we should really think about this. So I was like, ready for a radical change in my life. The twins were ready for radical change in their lives. And we went in and everything was set up. We didn't get sounds or anything. We got lunch, sat in the corner, we listened to some records. And he said, so what do you want to play? And we're like, well, we'll play you this song, you know? And we just played it for him, but he recorded it. And he's like, well, we got our first track. And I was like, wow, this is different. You know, how does it even sound? I got sounds before you got here. Don't worry about it. And the whole record was that way.
Beautiful.
Done in 2 weeks. Bursting into tears the whole time. Emotional breakdowns. Digging deep. Mining of the soul. New way that we had never done it before. And I knew it was different.
What's interesting about that is it sounds like by him taking care of the production and everything else, you got to really dive into being the artist.
You're right.
And not having to wear multiple hats and completely be in the music.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, now I want to do it again.
Yeah, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. I understand. Yeah, there's also, it's like what we talked about earlier, the idea that sometimes it's helpful to have someone outside who really likes you. You know, yeah. It's really helpful.
Yeah, that was helpful. Big. That was really big. And he just made me feel like he really liked my voice.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I have been in the studio with a lot of people that didn't like my voice.
Yeah.
And of course there's affectation and of course there's lots of reasons for that. But I just think that like that's part of making music that isn't manufactured, is that part of like growing as an artist, I think, is developing and shedding affectation.
Yes.
You can't strip a young person of the affectation. They have to decide to shed the affectation. And God, it could take a long time.
Yeah.
You know, it took me a long time.
It happens naturally, and mm-hmm. it happens when it wants to happen. It's not anything that can be forced. Mm. If you pull off the affectation before it comes off, we don't really know what's underneath.
That's so true. I've never heard it said that way before, but that's exactly why you can't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes from the person not knowing who they are yet. So this is the crutch or the training wheels till I get to be who I am. I'm gonna go through this vehicle.
Yeah.
The last time I saw you play was with the Avett Brothers at Madison Square Garden.
Right.
Which was incredible. It was an incredible night. Both seeing you and them there.
Yeah.
Was a place where I used to see, you know, big concerts when I was a little kid. It was a real thrill for me.
Oh, man, I love those boys.
Aren't they great?
I mean, it's more than that. I just feel like the world just needs them in a big, big way. And I need them. And yeah. Did you know Scott painted me for the cover of my album? By the way, I forgive
not.
You.
I did not. But that makes, now that you say it.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. He did. And this is how gay I am. I have such a crush on Scott. I think Scott is one of the most beautiful people I've ever met. And yes. I went to his house by myself in North Carolina to set for him and be painted. And I had to rent my very first car. I've never rented a car all by myself. And I went out there and I spent the entire day with Scott inside of a box that he created out of a sheet and some cardboard and the little light coming in at the top. And he was like this close to my face all day. And I was thinking, I feel nothing around this gorgeous specimen of a man. Like, this is how gay I actually am, because he's so handsome. And I was so nervous to be like, he's of course married father, I'm married and a mother, but I just love him.
But he's one of those people where he's as beautiful of a person as he is to look at.
Like,
he's
more just and more beautiful because of exactly that.
Yeah, we see him beautiful because it's his soul shining through.
You're exactly right. Yeah. And Seth is the same way.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing
and all those fellas and their parents and their wives and their kids. It's all the same thing. There's a big love light shining out of North Carolina because of them.
Yeah. I always feel like any chance I get to be around them improves my life.
Do you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, friend of mine made the documentary May It Last, Judd Apatow.
Yeah. A lot of it here.
And he's he works in comedy. Mm-hmm. And most of the people that we know in the comedy world tend to be dysfunctional. It's the nature of the reason you find yourself in comedy comes out of dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was laughing with Judd because he was saying what a great experience it was making this and how great it was to be around those people. And I said, you know, most of the people we know are insane. This is what, like, we don't know any, like, nice people.
Mm-hmm.
They're the only nice people I know.
That's how I feel, too.
It's like you can't believe that anyone is like this.
Yeah, but they are.
It's real.
Yeah, and you keep thinking you're waiting for the rug to get pulled. You're like, when I turn my back, you're going to do something weird. But they don't.
No. No, it's an incredible family. I don't know how it happened. I remember I asked their dad, when I met their dad the first time, I said, what did you do for these people to exist like this in the world?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I back them. I back them no matter what. I back them. If somebody came and told me that one of the boys killed somebody, I would say, I guess somebody needed some killing.
That is profound.
Yeah.
That's some parenting advice right there.
Yeah. Unconditional love.
Wow.
We'll be right back with the rest of Rick's interview with Brandi Carlile. We're back with Brandi Carlile. The night before this interview, Brandi performed Joni Mitchell's classic album, Blue, in its entirety at LA's Disney Concert Hall. She talked to Rick about how she first discovered Joni Mitchell's music.
I was really late to the game on Joni Mitchell, and there's a whole thing about it that I won't go into, but when I did, like, deep dive, I made up for lost time.
Yes.
In a really big way, and I became obsessed with the album Blue. I learned the entire thing. It was like my life, and then I got into Court and Spark.
How long ago was this?
So, 8.5, almost 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Skipped over For the Roses, went straight to Court and Spark, and then went back to Song for Siegel, all the way into Ladies of the Canyon, Blue, For the Roses, Court and Spark, Hissing of Summer Lawns, Hajira, which is now my favorite Joni Mitchell album, all the way up to Shine. So her 75th birthday party, which is almost a year ago to the day, they asked a lot of really cool people to come and tribute her by singing songs. And I wanted to do it so bad. I begged and begged and begged, and they wouldn't let me do it. And they told me no, and it was full. But I just kept writing letters, and I kept digging to find out other people that were connected to it and then writing them letters. And, you know, mom and dad said no, so I was asking all the aunties and uncles. And basically, because Kris Kristofferson got asked to do A Case of You, and I've been helping Kris a little bit on stage with his memory and his ability to kind of deliver a live performance that's not his own, like his own lyrics. He can do it with a teleprompter, but outside of that, he struggles with simple things like microphone placement and plugging in his guitar and stuff. So I've been kind of like, his wife says, like, she can help him to the edge of the stage, but after that, you know. So I stepped in a bunch of times to be with Kris, because he's still so special. And so he got asked to do A Case of You, so I was able to help him do that. And then they gave me Down to You from Court and Spark. So I did it. And I found it really transformative. And I brought this picture to have signed by Joni. And it was my wife, Catherine. It's like her one job to get it signed, and she didn't do it. She was a PA for Paul McCartney for like 10 years. So she's good at reading a room, you know? She just knew it wasn't appropriate. But I was so moved by the night. I said, I'm going to cover the entire Joni Mitchell Blue album at Disney Hall in L.A. a year from now. And she said, all right. And she called Joni's assistant and she said, well, can I get this picture signed for Brandy for Christmas? It's a surprise. And they said, yeah, bring it by the house and come on up and we'll get it signed. And so Catherine went by the house, but Joni invited her in and wound up sitting at the table with her and having a long talk about nature and Canada. And they kind of had a friendship thing. And Joni said, well, you know, anytime you and your wife want to get together and grab a bite to eat, you know, we can't. And after the Grammys, Joni reached out and she took me out to dinner and Catherine. And we had this amazing dinner. She ordered all of our food for us. It was like really special. And she said at the end of it, she didn't say much, but at the end of it, she said, you know, I don't do music anymore. And before you start feeling sorry for me and getting weird about it, I'm a painter. I'm not sad. But it does bother me that I have these instruments sitting around that are so beautiful and no one plays them. So if you want to get a few young people together, some people together, and you want to come over to my house and play some music one night, let's do a jam. And I was like, all right. So we did. The very first night, me and Hozier went over to Joni's house. And we had dinner. It was like Mexican food. Sat outside. And Joni like inadvertently tells the stories of her songs without telling us she's telling the stories of her songs. So if you know Joni, you know the story. And it's really amazing. You know, she'll talk about a turbulent flight she was on. And I was like, man, turn this bird around. And you know, like what she's talking about if you know Blue, you know. So that was fascinating part of the night. And then we kind of migrated into the living room around some instruments. And I played a song of mine called Cannonball. And then Andrew Hozier played a song. And we're in the middle of these songs. And like, apropos of nothing, Chaka Khan walks in. And Joni always has a plan. That's the thing about her. She wanted to, you know, surprise us and throw us for a loop and show us how it was done. So she invited some people we didn't know about. So Chaka Khan walks in, she starts throwing a fourth part harmony on top of this Crosby, Stills, and Nash song I was singing. And middle of that one, Herbie Hancock walks in. And he sits down at a piano, and we are just hyperventilating, me and Andrew, beside ourselves, and the twins. And my wife, and Joni's got this big, knowing, mischievous grin on her face. And Herbie starts hovering on a chord, you know, and he's like, what are the kids going to do, you know? How are we going to do this jam? We don't know what he's doing. It's just really diminished, and there's all these things happening, and he's playing, and everybody gets real quiet because we didn't know what was going to happen. And out of the middle of the room, we hear, summertime and the living is easy. And it's Joni who's just opened her mouth and sang for the first time since her aneurysm 7 years ago. Okay. Herbie burst into tears. Everybody burst into tears. Joni sat there grinning that mischievous grin. And Chaka goes, The fish are jumping and the cotton is high. And Jody goes, the fish are jumping and the cotton is high. And the next thing you know, Joni's singing again. And she sang for an hour and didn't stop. And so we've been going over there and jamming, and Joni's been singing. And that's how it goes.
So beautiful. You did, growing up, you didn't listen to Joni.
Mm-hmm.
What happened that got you into it?
Well, T-Bone Burnett played Blue for me when I was making the story. So that would have been 2005, 2006. And her voice was so high, and she got to the line that said, I want to renew you, I want to shampoo you, and I hated it. It was so heterosexual and submissive. It just bothered me. It was like, oh, this is not tough. This is some other thing. This is feminine. And I wrote it off. And then all these years later, I met my wife, and we were holed up in a cabin together in northern Michigan and listening to music. And she brought Damien Rice, and she brought Blue. And she put on Blue, and I laughed, and I said, oh, I don't really like Joni Mitchell, actually. And she got, like, deadly silent. And she was like, I don't actually know you like I thought I did if you can't get your head around Joni Mitchell. And I was like, well, it's just that I like tough singers, and she's just not tough. And I hate the lyric, I want to renew you, I want to shampoo you. And she goes, really, she's not tough, like, because she sounds like a feminine woman? And I was like, well, it's a lot more than that. And she goes, do you know what Little Green is about? And I said, no. And she told me, and she put on Little Green. And I broke down. I just completely broke down. And it changed not just the way I looked at Joni Mitchell, but the way I looked at women and femininity and toughness and how intertwined they really are. And so it put me in touch with my femininity in a new way. And so when I dove into Joni, I did a deep dive, because I realized that I wasn't just fundamentally wrong about Joni Mitchell. I was fundamentally wrong about what I thought it meant to be tough.
Beautiful story. It's amazing how small revelations can change our perception in great ways. That you wouldn't expect you not liking a lyric in a song.
Yep.
To frame the way you see the world. And just through that one, breaking through that one change, opened up yourself to a whole different way of seeing the world.
It really did.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'll never be the same writer after that either.
Beautiful. Yeah. Cool. Thanks for coming.
All right.
Cool.
Thank you to Brandi Carlile for stopping by Shangri-La and playing for Rick. Her latest album, the Grammy Award-winning By the Way I Forgive You, is out now. Be sure to check it out along with the rest of our favorite Brandi songs at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mila Bell, Leah Rose, Matt LaBoza, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.